and wailing. So, gratefully, there's not too much of anybody here who doesn't already know how totally ridiculous I can be. I like to think of myself as the ridiculous and reverent April May. So, both things can be true, right? Because we don't believe in duality. So this morning I'd like to start out with some gratitude, because gratitude practice is a significant one for many of us, and it's always a great place to start. We don't even start a meal without giving grace for what we haven't even yet received. So I'd like to say many thanks to all of you for being here this morning. You certainly could have used this as an excuse to be somewhere else, and thankfully you didn't. I'd like to say a very big gratitude to Aaron and Tiffany, who came here today. Tiffany, all the way from Lancaster, to share music with us today. So thank you. And also Demeter, Faye, Art Thomas, and the whole choir for honoring my music request, even if they weren't really in my best interest. And we are going to have some more wonderful music today. In our musical meditation and our inspirational moment. So hang on for that. And actually, I think Butch always says he already knows what he's talking about, so he comes to hear the music. I definitely believe in softening you guys up with great music before I get started. So, and actually, I think that they help do a lot of the work to get us started already, right? Yeah, so... I'd also like to thank Maxine for guiding us through today and being my trusty supporter, and Betty Ellis for the beautiful reading of the Daily Word. I'd also like to acknowledge and thank all of the committed ministers who do this creating of messages week after week after week. I know I have thanked God many times this week that I only have to do this occasionally. So I called Butch up at one point and I said, "So what are you talking about on Sunday?" He said, "That would be you this week." So I'd also like to acknowledge someone who's become a very important teacher for me in my life, Father Richard Rohr. He's a contemplative Franciscan monk who is part of the Center for Action and Contemplation. And his writings and meditations in the last year and a half have really come to mean a great deal to me. And I have caged some things from him today, which I will give him credit for. But I am very grateful for his contribution to my life and to this lesson. But there always is much to be grateful for, isn't there? This month, I don't know how many of you noticed, but our affirmation and our intention is, "I am blessed. I am blessed beyond measure." And that's why I wanted to start today with our gratitude. And so let's say that together. We are blessed.
We are blessed beyond measure.
We are blessed beyond measure. So how many of you are curious about this talk title, "Where is God?" Actually, I still am a little bit curious about it, because this is one I think that is a lifetime work. And I can tell you that when I was growing up, I was the fourth of six children, and I believe my mom was tired, because she used to call me the "why" kid. I was always asking, "Why is this so? Why is that so?" And so she always called me the "why" kid. And I think as I've gotten a little bit more mature, I've started to ask more functional questions than "why," because sometimes "why" doesn't always give you much information or much to work with. And so often now I'm asking questions like "what" and "where," because they're really more about where I am in the moment. But this question, "where is God?" has been working with me and in me for a while now. So before we jump into that discussion and other questions that may come up today, because after all, I am the "why" kid. Let's take a quick look at where we've come from most recently. We've spent several weeks during the Lenten season in our spiritual preparation for Easter, looking at what we would like to loose and let go of to lighten our load. Or as a friend of mine says, it's hard to get down off the cross, if you're carrying all your baggage with you. We've been asking ourselves if we're willing to fast from hurting words and speak kindness. We've been asking ourselves, are we willing to fast from pessimism and be filled with faith? Fast from worries and have trust in God? Fast from grudges and be reconciled? Are we even willing to fast from words and be silent so we can listen to our inner guidance? Well, those of you who have been around me in the last few weeks know that I've had an opportunity to be silent some because my voice hasn't always been everything that I'm used to it being. And tell me that's not been a great spiritual practice. To be silent when you like to talk as much as I do. It has been a blessing, and it's gotten me here today. So we should continue to pray as I move through this lesson that the voice holds out. Just last Sunday, we had a glorious celebration, and we made room for this new beginning that we call the resurrection. As we recall from that day and the reading from our Keep It True Lent booklet, the message he brought was brilliantly clear for all generations to hear. The things that I do, you will do too. I came to bring life in abundance to you. So as we recall that first Easter day and we turn within, we experience peace in heart and in mind, for it's there deep within the Christ we find. So coming away from our joyous Easter celebration and a lot of reflection, contemplation, and discussion about resurrection and what that means to each of us, personally, I'm challenged to look more deeply at the truth of my being and even to examine this question, where is God in my life? A story is told of two young boys who were always getting in trouble. The boy's mother heard that a wise man was coming to town who was successful in steering young folks in the right direction, and she asked if he would speak with her sons. He agreed, but he asked to see them separately. So they sent the youngest son first. The wise man, who was a big man with a booming voice, sat the boy down and asked him sternly, "Where is God?" The boy's mouth dropped open, but he made no response. And the wise man repeated the question in an even sterner tone, "Where is God?" Again, the boy made no attempt to answer. The wise man then raised his voice and bellowed, "Where is God?" The boy bolted out the door, ran home, and hid in a closet. Well, when his older brother found him hiding, he asked him what happened. The younger brother, still wide-eyed and gasping for breath, replied, "We are in big trouble this time. God is missing, and they think we did it." I love that story. And one of the reasons I love it is because I can identify with it. So if we paid much attention to the songs we had before I started this talk, which I know we did, God is, and God is inside and all around me, it would seem like that the answer to that question of where is God would be rather simple, right? I mean, that's what Sam told me last week. He said I didn't need to say anything else other than God was inside and all around me. So, and it really says very clearly in the first of Unity's five principles and the foundation statement that we repeat every week, there is only one power and one presence active in my life and affairs, God the good, omnipotent. And we say that, and we say it, and we say it. This all-powerful presence is also omnipresent. So not just all-powerful, but everywhere occurring. There's no place where God is not. God in all, through all, around all, pressing out through me, through you, through all of us. And God is omniscient, all-knowing, infinite knowledge, unlimited wisdom. God knows all. So as far as spiritual principle, most likely we can say we agree that our God is all-powerful, everywhere present, and all-knowing. Can we agree on that? Okay. Well, just like the two boys in the story, the biggest trouble we can get in, at least this is true for me, I shouldn't talk about you, is when I don't operate from the universal truth of those core principles. What I call the knowing with a little K instead of a big K, right? I could say these to you. I'm a licensed teacher. I'm supposed to be able to say them in order. But do I live from them? Do I act from them? Do I speak from them? Well, in situations like disease, war, mass shootings, the death of a loved one, it can be easy to find ourselves asking, where is God in this? How can this be permitted by a loving, all-powerful, everywhere present God? Well, I would pose that first and foremost, if we are willing to commit to an acceptance that the circumstances of our life, all of them, pretty, not so pretty, all of the circumstances of our life are the curriculum of our spiritual development. We talk about being in a classroom, right? Well, this is the lesson plan. This is a platform for discovering more of our true selves. Who and what do I show up as? Our ultimate unfolding. If we can be willing to commit to that acceptance, we will be committing ourselves to a life lived from truth principle. Not that I'm saying it's easy. Sometimes we forget to remember. When we're health challenged, or we're grieving, or we're worrying, or we're struggling. But if we are willing, just willing, to be committed to these truth principles, that this particular one is so, God is all good and active in everything, everywhere. Let's say that together. God is all good and active in everything, everywhere. I don't know how many of you remember a book from a number of years ago called The Prayer Chest. It was written by August Gold. We did a book study on it here. And in that book, August Gold said, we must be grateful for everything, everywhere, all the time, without question. That's not a very equivocating statement, is it? Everything, everywhere, all the time, without question. Well, a young woman we'll call Alice, no resemblance to the name of April, Alice, questioned August and said, but I want to change the world. August assured her that if her intention was to change the world, beginning with being grateful for everything instead of complaining would be a perfect place to begin. Alice didn't understand how that would work, but she was willing and committed to develop a new habit of being grateful for everything. I've heard it said that you only have to do something 21 times in order to develop a new habit. Well, I can personally attest that I have most definitely acquired new habits in less than 21 tries, especially bad habits. We'll check back in on Alice later in the talk. I don't know how many of you have noticed, but in the last several months, not only are our vision, mission, and foundation statements in our bulletin every week, but if you look at your bulletin and you take a look at the back, we also have our core values as a community and the five unity principles. The core values are a group of five words that we as a community came together a number of years ago and agreed upon. Do any of you remember that process where we spent time choosing words? It does seem like it was a long time ago, doesn't it, Joe? Yeah. But the group collectively, now, and this was a large group, right, actually agreed to five words. Love, wholeness, spiritual awakening, oneness, and sacred service. From there, a smaller group of people was tasked with fleshing out each word with a statement of what that word represented. As sometimes happens, the group whittled itself down from 4 to 2. You know how that goes sometimes, right? And I went to work on the descriptions of these 5 key words with Sharon Bachman. What a blessing. And I was blessed beyond measure to have that experience, and we forged a bond in the process of agreeing and disagreeing about what the definitions of those words were. Sharon was very declarative and very clear about what she believed, thought, and felt, and she was perfectly willing to share that with me. And in the process, though, she also really embodied that statement that love is an inner quality that sees good everywhere, in everyone and everything. Well, Sharon once said to me during these discussions, again, quite clearly and with strong conviction, we must operate from a basic spiritual assumption that this is true for all of us all the time. Even when we're not expressing it fully, and most especially when on the outer level of appearances, it doesn't seem so. As a matter of spiritual truth, it's even more important to work from this premise when things or people, or even ourselves, feel or look bad. When Sharon made this statement, I had no doubt whatsoever in the deepest part of my soul that not only did she believe it deeply, but that I would probably never doubt it again with the conviction she spoke from. It really is in alignment with our second unity principle. I am naturally good because God's divinity is in me and in everyone. Now, you'll notice there are a variety of different ways to say some of these principles. Some of them are the way we teach them to the kids. I personally like those better because they're easier to remember. I am naturally good because God's divinity is in me and in everyone. So let's share that together. I am naturally good because God's divinity is in me and in everyone. So, Reverend Eric Butterworth wrote a book called Discover the Power Within, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with. And I actually like the foreword to the book as much as anything else he's written in the book. And I'd like to share with you the Hindu legend that he shared in the front of the book. There was a time when all men were gods, but they so abused their divinity that Brahma decided to take it away and hide it where they would never again find it. Where to hide it became the big question. When the lesser gods were called in to consider, they said, well, we will bury man's divinity deep in the earth. But Brahma said, no, that'll not do, for man will dig deep down into the earth and find it. And then they said, well, we'll sink his divinity into the deepest ocean. But Brahma again replied, no, not there, for man will learn to dive into the deepest waters. We'll search out the ocean bed and we'll find it. And then the lesser god said, well, we will take it to the top of the highest mountain and there hide it. But again, Brahma replied, no, for man will eventually climb every high mountain on earth. He will be sure someday to find it and take it up again for himself. Then the lesser gods gave up and concluded, we don't know where to hide it, for it seems there's no place on earth or in the sea that man will not eventually reach. And then Brahma said, here's what we'll do. We will hide it deep down in man himself, for he will never think to look for it there. Ever since then, the legend concludes, man has been going up and down the earth, climbing, digging, diving, exploring, searching for something that is already in himself. Jesus shared this secret with us more than 2,000 years ago. But in the movement that sprang up in his name, the divinity of man has been one of the best kept secrets of the ages. We must ask ourselves, where is God? To be reminded that we already know the answer to that question. So we check back in on Alice, and we find that the more she practices radical gratitude, even when she doesn't fully understand it, the more she actually finds to be grateful for. And the less it seems that she's labeling people, circumstances, or life as good or bad. As a result, she begins to feel more inner peace and out of that quiet space receives guidance that her next step is to offer more love and kindness to herself and others. She commits once again to be willing, in this case, to be willing to be more kind and loving as her newest habit. Not that she didn't experience worries or fears, but even when she experienced worries or fears, even when we experience worries or fears, we want to be willing to exercise our habit of holding still to that inner spark of divinity and go for what feels truly right. One of the co-founders of our movement, Charles Fillmore, often said, "We must feel after God. Not think about, not rationalize, but feel after God." This is in alignment with our third unity principle. I create my experiences by what I choose to think and what I feel and believe. So let's say that together. I create my experiences by what I choose to think and what I feel and believe. Amen on that one. In unity, we say thoughts held in mind reproduce after their own kind. Our willingness to ask ourselves questions like, "Where is God?" and be with what reveals itself to us may be clarifying to the changing nature of God in our lives. Not saying that God is changing, but that our experience of co-creating with God changes in conjunction with the thoughts that we continuously hold in mind. I'm reminded of the story in the Bible where Jesus is standing before Pontius Pilate for judgment. Pilate keeps asking him if he is the Son of God in an attempt to trap him. Jesus' response over and over again is to ask Pilate, "Who is it that you say I am? Who is it that you say I am?" My belief is that this story and Jesus' challenge to Pilate was an invitation to take a look at who it is we say God is for us. For isn't it true that this can be a place in consciousness where our spiritual awakening can come from? We may have five unity principles, but I often say that if we can just get number one, we may not even need the rest of them. Is it possible that in asking the questions and being willing to sit with our thoughts about those questions, there may be a clue to what we are holding in our mind and heart, and thus what our experience of the world is like? Alice, her habits of gratitude and loving kindness, they're already changing her world and her relationship to it. She notices that her creativity is expanding, and she not only offers more love and kindness, she's also the recipient of much more love and kindness. Unity also says that through affirmative prayer and meditation, I connect with God and bring out the good in my life. So let's say that together. Through affirmative prayer and meditation, I connect with God and bring out the good in my life. Amen on that one. Or said another way, through prayer and meditation, we align our heart and mind with God. A commitment to a prayer and meditation practice is one of the surest connections to these core values that are on the back of our bulletin. Wholeness, spiritual awakening, oneness. In a prayer place, in a meditation place, how many of us have felt the power of that connection to those words? If you look at just the core values of spiritual awakening and oneness, and you resonate with those, but you never make time to pray and meditate, you must ask yourself, where is God in this situation? Not so much where is God putting God's self, but where am I putting God? Sort of the, am I putting where my money, where my mouth is kind of thing. If I say that spiritual awakening is a core value in my life, am I living from that core value? It's all well and good to give it lip service, but am I living from that core value? A committed practice of meditation was that something that escaped me for a long time. No time, busy head, different mantras, different methods, couldn't sit still, you know. Sometimes my meditation practice looked like settle in, the phone rings. Get back in my body, remind myself of all its imperfections, you know, over and over and over again, right? I tried the different mantras and the methods, and nothing quite seemed to stick. But I just kept setting aside the time. Because if you remember what Charles Fillmore said, that he was someone that had to have it proved to him. Well, I'm a show me gal. So I said, I'm going to keep doing this because it ain't over until I give up. Breathing and being still. One day a thought came to me, not from my own mind, clearly from divine mind. God is breathing me. I am breathing. I am breathing and God is breathing as me. I realized I'd been operating, this was such a revelation, from a concept that meditation in particular was a passive activity. And no wonder I was impatient with it. I was all about activity. There was even an inner thought that maybe it was a waste of time. I was being honest with myself about how I was letting myself get in the way of my meditation practice. But in that moment of God is breathing as me and I am breathing, I realized that quite contrary to what the thought that I was holding in mind, that meditation was indeed a very active practice and that my willingness to continue to commit in spite of the appearance of results, whether or not I thought I was doing it right, whether the world was cooperating by being quiet or not in my way, that my meditations were always successful as long as I took the time to just do them. Father Richard Rohr, the contemplative Franciscan monk that I told you about, says this, through contemplation, individuals can experience God for themselves and need not be dependent on clergy or others. Faithfulness to contemplative practice can achieve radical inner renewal. Contemplation addresses the root, the underlying place where illusion and ego are generated. Meditation touches the unconsciousness where most of our wounds and need for healing lie. With contemplation and meditation, I think we have a likelihood of producing actual elders for the next generation and not just elderly people. This guy may be a Franciscan monk, but I think he's a unity Franciscan monk. Well, what he's talking about is a very engaged contemplative meditation approach and far from anything even resembling passive activity. Well, as Alice became even more committed to her habits of gratitude and loving kindness, she found herself connecting with the Center for Action and Contemplation. And she became a student of contemplative meditation. She began to feel more energy to engage with others in working together and began to feel the possibility of changing the world. The Center for Action and Contemplation was a loving and kind community for her to do that work within. She has become a mentor and a living example in that community and in the world of changing the world through gratitude and loving kindness. Embracing that challenging times can lead to transform lives, can change how we operate in the world. In other words, what we addressed earlier, the circumstances of our lives are the curriculum of our spiritual development. Now, I said curriculum, not punishment, not judgment, right? I'm a much more vengeful God on myself than my God has ever been on me, right? You hear me talking on that one, don't you? If we are willing, once again, to embrace this curriculum, these lessons our lives bring to us and for us, instead of resisting them, We can grow and learn and be a force for good in our relationships, our families, our communities, and our world. It's pivotal to that we remember as often as we can that the challenges we encounter are not in our way. They are our way. They are not in our way. They are our way. They're our way to transformation, upliftment, and a compassionate, loving life. In unity, we are reminded that it is not enough to know spiritual principles. One must live the truth he or she knows. Our fifth unity principle says, knowledge of spiritual principles is not enough. We must live the truth we claim to know, the difference between the small K and the big K. So let's say that together. Knowledge of spiritual principles is not enough. We must live the truth we claim to know. Father Richard Rohr also had something to say about this. He says, Christianity is a lifestyle, a way of being in the world that is simple, nonviolent, shared, and loving. And who couldn't say that we could use more simplicity, nonviolence, and shared love? He goes on to say, however, we made it into an established religion and all that comes with that, and we avoided the lifestyle change. So this fifth principle, it's not enough to know. We must live. That's the lifestyle that he's talking about. Going deep to the roots of these spiritual principles and the core values that we say that we believe in and have faith in can nurture that divine spark within each of us that we've talked about already to kindle a flame of diligent and committed truth practices. In other words, like he said, a lifestyle. From this place, we can change ourselves, the ways we operate in the world, and even, as Alice said, change the world itself. As I get ready to close today, I'd like to share a story with you that came to me without any looking or seeking on my part. And it seemed to me that it really illustrated this idea that wherever it is that we say God is where we show up in the world as this lifestyle, right? And I was deeply touched by this story. And it occurred shortly after the end of the Second World War in Kyoto, Japan. And it was during the occupation, at a time when there were plenty of reasons to hate and judge and be afraid of. This woman had become the principal of the American school in Kyoto. One of the kindergarten teachers came to her office to inform her that the 8-year-old son of one of the Japanese kindergarten assistants had died the previous night. I immediately suggested that the 5 American kindergarten teachers and I call at the bereaved home to pay our respects. On the way, we purchased flowers and fruit, a Japanese custom, as evidence of our concern and respect. When we arrived at the home, the mother was away making the funeral arrangements, but the child's grandmother, on her knees, opened the sliding door and, bowing low, invited us in. We're going to breathe through this one. After removing our shoes, we entered and were seated. Typical of their culture, the grandmother was determined not to show her grief. But the surprise visit by people who were so recently at war with her country broke through her resolve, and she could not conceal the tears which dimmed her eyes. After the grandmother had placed our flowers and fruit on a small silk-covered altar, one of the teachers realized that our hostess wished me to kneel in prayer at this altar. The young teachers immediately joined me. So a Buddhist grandmother, 6 Americans, I a Presbyterian, a Baptist, 2 Catholics, a Jew, and a Lutheran, Sounds like the beginning of a joke, doesn't it? All knelt together in prayer in this home where sorrow had laid its heavy hand. I could not but wonder whose voice was heard. Each, I thought. And then I wished that the whole world might look in on this scene where the death of a child had brought together in a common bond people diverse in customs, language, race, and creed, and where the consuming hatred of the recent war melted away under the light of human sympathy, understanding, and love. Prejudice, however deeply ingrained, would, I thought, fall away like a shabby garment, and peace and goodwill to men would come nearer to realization. A little child shall lead them, I remembered. To us, Americans, our mission was a normal response when sorrow lays its load, and our reward was the inner satisfaction of having done what decent people ought to do. However, word of our visit spread among the Japanese employed at our school and widely through the Japanese community at large. The harvest of goodwill manifested in uncounted ways that came to us and to Americans generally. This was an unhoped-for reward. When the mother returned to the school, she came to my office, and as she attempted to thank me for our thoughtfulness, in spite of her resolve, tears cascaded down her face, and she could but put her head on my shoulder and weep, as mothers everywhere must do when death takes one of their own. When she had recovered somewhat, she placed in my tie a beautiful pearl, perhaps her only jewel, as an expression of gratitude, but also, I thought, as an appropriate symbol of the love and mutual respect that we were beginning to develop between the Japanese and American people. And so, to this day, I hold this pearl of great price as a cherished memento of an experience born in sorrow, yet rich in love, in which the death of a child cemented the bonds of friendship and love between two peoples and reaffirmed the essential kinship of the whole human race. And so it is. Amen.